Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Sermon Postscript, where we dissect and just discuss the sermon that we preached on this past Sunday. So I had the privilege of preaching out of Mark 5, talking about two interesting healings that Jesus kind of undertook and sandwiched together. But yeah, we'll start that, and Jay's with me as well.
Hey, how's it going? Yeah, and thanks again, Eugene, for speaking and preaching the Word of God for us this morning.
Of course.
Yeah. So one of the questions, that I was thinking of as you were preaching was really, the first point when you were kind of dissecting the differences between pride and shame, and how in the two characters, whether it's the bleeding woman or whether it was Jairus, they struggled with, pride or shame, and how Jesus kind of really exposed that. How do you feel that pride and shame, how does it manifest itself? A lot of, in our individual community members at our church in True North.
Yeah, I think it's actually really intertwined too. I should have talked about this more, but I think pride and shame are kind of two of the same coin, just different sides. The pride portion, I do think a lot of people are in this like consumer, observer, like passenger mentality at True North. And I don't mean that to be disrespectful, but I think when you read the Gospels, especially Gospel of Mark, like you can never just sit there and observe Jesus. Like to actually, you can, but that doesn't mean you're interacting with him. That means you're the crowds. That means you might be the Pharisees, but that probably means you're not actually having an actual interaction with him. And I think a lot of kind of, we don't think it's pride, but a lot of us have that same type of feeling where we just kind of, oh, that's a good sermon, and like, oh, I hope this person heard it. Or even in community group, I've had this temptation like, oh, they won't get my struggles. Like, I'm not going to share that. And I think a lot of that's wrapped up in this like idea that we want to control a lot of aspects of our lives. We don't want to give that up. And I think shame's kind of actually intertwined, that I think oftentimes pride can lead to shame, because let's say you are prideful and something disastrous happens, or you fall into a major sin of whatever nature, right? It's so hard to then share it because you're already thinking like, oh, I'm self-sufficient. And it goes from I can fix myself to I can't be fixed at all. And I just think a lot of us here at True North, and a lot of us just as people, carry that kind of symptom.
Yeah. As you're mentioning that, one of the questions that popped up in my head was, how do you distinguish between shame and humility?
Yeah, that's a good question. Are you talking in terms of just like how you share certain sins in your life?
Yeah, I feel like shame can become the negative manifestation of humility, if that makes sense. Where as Christians we are taught to be humble, but we don't know how to distinguish what humility and shame kind of looks like.
Yeah. Like I think especially for our Asian American congregants too, not that, I think specifically this kind of relates to that as you talked about it, that I do think we're taught, and this is actually a lot of us, we're taught to maybe hide our failures because that's the righteous kind of honorable thing to do. Like you don't want to deface your family. And I understand that too, because like, a lot of that is, you're going to face a lot of unwarranted shame when you do, when you are humble, and that might stop you from that. But I think that the biggest kind of differentiating factor is just understanding why you're sharing or why not you're sharing, if that makes sense. I think if it's wrapped up in your self-image and reputation, I think that's more shame than humility. I do think there's times where like people share too much, I'm talking about, like it becomes a broken fest, like, oh, like I have the most broken past. And yeah, that's definitely not fighting shame. That's just not being humble, which I think you get to. And I think that the motivation is the root of that problem that you talk about.
So, with Jairus, a high ranking official who probably had a lot more privilege than the bleeding woman. And when we kind of think about our lives and our situations, whenever we are put in a position where we have a lot of privilege, sometimes we use that to kind of make sure that our lives go according to our plans.
Right? Yeah.
What are ways that you feel that our church members, or even just people in general, still try to control every aspect of our lives, while trying to follow Jesus, which is an oxymoron, right?
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I think And this is the thing. I'm not trying to shame people for even... I think, especially for those that are skeptical of the church, I think even attending our service is a huge step. And I'm not trying to discredit that at all. And this is more, I guess, to our church folk. But I think if you grew up in the church or you're used to this type of environment, it's really easy to you know, fake your way through it and to really not engage fully. Like, you know how to share things in community group where, like, every sin is, like, a past victory. Like, oh, I struggled with porn last week, but, you know, like, it's over. And, like, it's interesting, too. I don't know if you noticed this, too, but, like, the testimonies people share, it's always, like, a linear progression, like a Disney, like, oh, I went through these falls, but this, I met Jesus and, like, everything's good. And I think we all kind of hear that and want to mimic that. And I'd love to hear a testimony where people are like, yeah, I follow Jesus and like man, I still watch porn, or like, man, I still struggle with money. Because I think that's more of an honest depiction of our faith in this earth. So I think a lot of it is just, you know, you know when you're kind of hiding things for a reason, whether it be, you know, church recognition, why I'm trying to be a certain leader or trying to gain some certain like self respect from people. And I think a lot of that's just like how much you're sharing and you know, I think you need people to really dig in your life to ensure you're not at that place. Because a lot of us do it subconsciously. At least I do, especially as a pastor, you know, and you need friends to kind of dig.
You know, and I'm also thinking about how we're so good at making compartments in our lives. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. There's the spiritual department of our life, and we might give Jesus a little bit of control on that side, you know, and actually we might give too much control. It's just like, hey, you take the wheel, Jesus, like my sanctification is in your hands, you know, but when it comes to like family and career or even just our hobbies or whatever the case is, we hope that Jesus will kind of fall in line with our plans, right?
Totally. And I think that's what I got from the passage, that like, why is this, like, why is Jesus stopping this? Is because it's like, this girl's about to die, dude. But I was like, oh, I think there's elements, even when how Jairus approached Jesus, like he thought he was still in control. Like, hey, Jesus, you take care of my spiritual part so I can get back to my life type of deal. And I really think, like, including me, I fall into that trap all the time.
And when I think about control, I think about just kind of how we've developed this understanding of like main characters in stories. So like, you know, like when we watch movies or when we read books, there's a main character and we watch how everything is kind of centered around that character. And totally. In many ways, in our own lives, we are our own main character. And totally. And we see, you know, Jesus kind of as the best supporting actor, you know, to our story. And so, when we read this passage, we think the main characters are the bleeding woman, or Jairus and his daughter, you know, but it is really Jesus that's kind of driving the story and driving the narrative of what he's trying to accomplish, you know. A funny story, my friend who went on missions with YWAM, he was out in Mauritius for, you know, 3 months, and one of his missions teammates was, it was his birthday the next day, so
yeah.
He was praying for good waves so he can go surfing, you know. It was like, they're like right by the beach. And so he was, but my friend was like, hey, you know, if you're praying for good waves, that means all the fishermen have to dock their boats for a whole day because they can't fish and they can't, you know, they can't make a living. And he was just like, yeah, but it's my birthday, you know? And so then the next day it was wavy. It was really wavy. So all the fishermen had to like dock their boats. But this guy was like, oh, I'm so blessed. Like God did this for me, you know? And I think there's that kind of mentality that we have where we're trying to, we want to kind of control, not only control our lives, but have control God to make sure that our lives go according to our plans. Right.
Yeah. No, I think that's really good that you touched on that too. And I think that control, not only does it ignore God, like you said, but it also makes you ignore the people around you. Like, because you're the main character and Jesus is your supporting actor, everyone is like just a minor, you know, like what do you call, extra in your life, you know? Right? But when in reality, everyone in their own life is a main character of sorts, you know? And I think like even in the story, it's like the daughter is 12 years old and Mark makes a note of that. And he also makes a note that the bleeding woman has suffered this for 12 years. And I think it's to kind of also remind you, like, yeah, the daughter is in dire danger, but this is something that happened early in her life and she's enjoyed it. But I think what Mark's trying to get at, this bleeding woman, for the whole entirety of this child's life, has been living in the same situation that she finds herself in, but just more of an emotional state. That she is dead almost, you know, to the people around her. So I think that's really important. You know, it's a quick story, but like, you know how you share the mission story? There's an article that I thought was really like a wake-up call to American Christianity, where it was like, you know, we go on these Mexico mission trips and we build these houses. And there was an article where, like, when you look around, there's able-bodied men in that village that could have gotten paid to do your job. But because you want a photo op and feel better about your spiritual life, you take that opportunity from them. And I was like, man, that's, like you said, it's just a great symptom of the dangers of American Christianity right now.
Yeah, for sure. You know, one of the points that you were making in the sermon was the kind of the different socioeconomic standards between the bleeding women and Jairus and his family. And definitely one of the things that I feel like Jesus came to kind of dismantle and deconstruct is the barriers and kind of almost the caste system that has existed all throughout humanity, right? And even in our culture, in our day, right? So, but when we think specifically about our church culture and, you know, because we would be fooling ourselves if we thought that there is no hierarchy even in our church, right? So at True North, what are some social ladders that you feel that need to be addressed and maybe even repented of and dismantled?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'd also want your thoughts too. I think a couple of things that come to my mind is, and we talked a lot about this, marriage and kids. I think all age groups from parents to singles think that parenthood is somehow this elite club of like, you know, that we should all aspire to, that will give us what we think we want and allows us a free pass at church. And, you know, I want to be, I'm a parent of two kids. It's crazy and it's hard to serve. But I also think like, you know, it's so often when we place these ladders, the top think that they get this like, you know, exemption card from a lot of things. And I want to be sensitive. I'm not, you know, trying to, you know, diminish parenthood and how hard it is. But I do think, man, I wish our parents would be more active and serve. And not to like use them, but because, man, they have so many things to give to the people at our church that are in need, you know, like loneliness, whatever it may be, even broken families. I talk about this a lot. I wish the church would open their families in the church would open their households to those that maybe have broken families. Because look, they might never see a healthy family until you show them. So that's one thing that I often think about. I'd love to hear what you think too.
Yeah, I do think, you know, within a church context and not just our own church, there is a unspoken hierarchy where if you are married with kids that you've reached the final stage of your metamorphosis, you know?
And, the holy of holies.
Yeah, but and here's the thing, like, and that's the way that privilege works, is that when you're in the privileged class, you never think of it as, oh yeah, I know I'm privileged and I'm going to take advantage of this. It just is, right? But I think one thing that I do want to mention is to kind of alleviate the onus on our parents and our married couples is the church has done probably a poor job of educating what service looks like. You know, because we've grown up always thinking, hey, you need to serve the church. You need to serve the church. And what that means is you need to, you know, be a part of a department. You need to join a worship team or join a, you know, welcome team, whatever the case is. And those are your only ways to serve. But I look at service as a holistic, organic thing, right? There are ways that you can officially join teams, but the other ways is to really serve and build relationships with people around you. And I think what parents may not have the freedom to do, they might not have the ability to commit to like a weekly service team, or they may not even have the skills to do so. But what they do have is the ability to reach out and build relationships with others, you know. And I think and we see that a lot within our church as well, you know. And it's, and that's the thing with the organic ministries, right, is that you don't get the visible, you know, the rewards or the, you know. But and I think it's just a matter of us being able to kind of not only educate but also model what that looks like, you know, and elevate those type of ministries, which I think a lot of a lot of our families are participating in, you know. But totally. But I think, yeah, there is, besides that, there is kind of a social ladder where we believe that if someone is married with kids, that they're automatically spiritually mature, you yeah. know, that the only way a person can get married and have children is because God rewards them for their spiritual maturity.
Yeah.
When in reality, that is not the case, you know, because yeah. I know some single people who are my age or older who are very spiritually mature and they are still single. I know some married couples who are my age, younger or older with kids who are definitely not the definition of spiritual maturity, you know? So I think that's one thing that I would love to see dismantled, that notion that married with children means that you are sanctified.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I if you have kids, your sanctification takes a pause sometimes. You know what I'm talking about? But I totally agree. And you know, one side note too, and this is on a bigger scale, and I want to say this for Jay's sake, like, I think recently this past year, like Jay and I have taught or preached about things that at times can make people feel uncomfortable, justice, race, politics. And, you know, I don't really get the flack. Jay does because he's the lead pastor. So I can do whatever I want. But one thing I would say to those that criticize us is, look, we hope to not be partisan. But the reason that we do talk about, you know, maybe what people think is too political or hey, this is like, this isn't in the scripture, is when I read scripture carefully, and I think Jay too, Jesus is not here just to save your little American family life. He's here to speak into every corner of society. I think a lot of that warrants us speaking about things that make people feel uncomfortable. And, you know, the danger is we try and not do that in a partisan way. And I think Jay and I try to do that as carefully as possible. But I hope people know, like, we're not trying to be hip or political or cool. But I just, when I even read this passage, Jesus needs to speak about the current issues of the day. And as Christians, we need to know how the gospel informs those type of decisions and the injustices that we do see today too.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and this is what we're touching upon is kind of a preview of our next week's message in Mark chapter 8, where I think a lot of times we are seeing only partially who Jesus is and what he has come to do. Yeah. And you know, when we are able to fully recognize what it is he actually came to do, there is a whole world of things that we can and should be discussing,
yeah,
you know, and not just kind of ignoring. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, the last thing that you mentioned was really talking about the object of our faith, right? And,
yeah.
And I think a lot of times we've really been taught to think about the quantity and quality of our faith, you know, like how faithful are you, you know, how much faith do you have, you know, and maybe that's just part of kind of like maybe a slight misinterpretation of, you know, the faith a size of a mustard seed can move mountains, you know, and you're just like, that's a size of a mustard seed, then hey, just give me a faith of an egg and let me do some crazy stuff. But you know, the reality is not so much how much faith we have, but the object of the thing that we have our faith in, right? And so looking at that, how can we strengthen our faith in the object of our faith?
Yeah, and not the faith itself. Yeah. I think that's an important
question. You know, I hate using that Keller example because I think we've both used it, like, you know, too much, but it's just too good not to use.
You can't talk right? bad about anything Tim Keller does.
Yeah.
Well, not anything. I don't want to put him on that pedestal, but he's a very great pastor, communicator, and preacher. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think what he's getting at in that example about, you know, if you jump off a cliff and you cling onto a rock with whatever faith you have, it's not how hard you believe in, but the object. That example is just, it helps me so much in how we should even approach Christian life. So often it's always, you know, it's always about us. It's always about what we know. It's always about what we can look at my prayer life. Look at what I've done. Look at my clean record of my profanity or my sexual history. And look, those are important things and God does care about them, but it's not to be used to flaunt around others or even to yourself. And I think the most important thing that I took out from this passage, and I always do when I read the Gospels, is that we never fall in love with Christ. It's always trying to make ourselves feel like we're good lovers, if that makes sense. And like, I'm still struggling, you know, what does that exactly look like? It's hard for us as Westerners. But, you know, one, I'm doing a book club through the book called You Are What You Love. And I like what Jamie Smith says, where he says, so much of our discipleship is bound up on what we think we know is what will change us, but it's ultimately what you love that will change you. And this isn't just about talking about Christianity. It's any aspect of your life. Like, you can want to work out and you know, love the image of it, the thought of it, which I do all the time. I always dream, like, I'm going to wake up, go on a run, drink a coffee, and then get my kids. But when the alarm goes off, it's like, oh, you love the idea of it, but you don't actually love the actual state of getting fit or whatever it may be. And I think for us, it's a lot of that, is changing this idea that knowledge will not save you. Your heart's direction ultimately will, if that makes sense. And I think it's just learning to fall in love with Jesus more. That sounds cheesy, but I think, honestly, for me, that's not something we do. I never just spend time to think about him and just do that, because it's like, it's not efficient. You know, if I'm honest, I can't tell people I did that, because that's not something you can really brag to people. And I think our church, every church, including us, we got to just grow in that, of like sitting in Jesus' presence and just not reading the Bible to take things out, but just to see him and to feel comforted, to you know, learn how to love him more with our imagination and with our hearts.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I see a lot of times we treat our spiritual disciplines, or even just our relationship with God, more as a elective course that we take at college. You know, like a 2-unit class, and you know, we just got to take a quiz every week, write a paper at the end, but like you said, it's not about like what we know, but it's like who we know and who we love.
Yeah.
And really understanding that Jesus is a person that's still alive and in heaven with Christ, our God, today, and to love him. I think that's the easy answer, but also, you know, difficult thing to do. Yeah.
I totally agree. But yeah. Hey, thanks for listening. Again, we're really excited to continue this series through Mark and ultimately climax in Easter with this series. But yeah, we hope you're a blast, and hope to see you next week.
All right, see you guys next week.